Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When a Sacramento resident called police to report a person breaking car windows on the evening of March 18th, local law enforcement sent police officers to the scene and sheriff's deputies in a helicopter. Two officers, one white and one black, confronted Stephon Clark, a 22-year-old father of two, in his grandmother's backyard. When an officer called out a warning about a gun, the two policemen fired 20 times. Stephon Clark was shot 8 times and killed. An independent autopsy found 6 of the bullets hit him in the back. No gun was recovered at the scene. Police found only a cell phone. There have been continuous protests and actions since the shooting. Stephon Clark's funeral drew hundreds of people and national media attention. Tomorrow, Sacramento Black Lives Matter will mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. with a national day of action and a rally to remember Stephon Clark. The event will take place at the Sacramento DA's office from 3 to 5:30. After years of movements calling out the disparities in police use of force against people of color, why is this still happening and what is being done about it? We have covered these issues for years on this show. Joining us today is Adriana Camarena. She is a San Francisco-based activist accompanying the family of police shooting victims, including Luis Gongora Pat. He was shot and killed in the San Francisco neighborhood of the Mission District almost 2 years ago by two police officers. And Adriana joins me in studio. Hi, Adriana. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose. How are you?
Well, thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Neil Franklin, Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Reform Group, Law Enforcement Action Partnerships. He's a 34-year law enforcement veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. Hi, Neil. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Barry Axius is a community activist in Sacramento who founded The Voice of the Youth. That's a group that mentors at-risk youth struggling with schools, their peers, or their families. And Barry joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Barry. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, Barry, we've done these shows so many times, and here we are again. There have been continuous protests on the streets of Sacramento and constant national media attention. What has your experience been like on the streets? What are you hearing from people?
You know, it's been real, and the reason why this continues to happen and be in the headlines is because we've had no real justice, no accountability for police terror in our community until we have accountability, until these henchmen, when they do these heinous acts, until they are prosecuted and thrown in jail, then you won't have these copycats running around the country thinking that they can kill black people. In 2014, I want to be very clear that I told the Sacramento City Council that we are one national moment away from being Ferguson. Some shrugged, some thought that I was kind of like, you know, speaking from the rafters, but understanding the climate that black folks have been in with police, and there's never been a true relationship, that we were just again, one national moment away for us to really be where we are now in 2018, struggling with this situation, because it's never been a real true moment where police and the black community were cohesive. And so when you see what's happening now, it was just the quiet before the storm, and now we're in the midst of just chaos.
Barry, according to the city of Sacramento, there have been 9 officer-involved shootings in the last couple of years. And just to let people know who don't live in the state, Sacramento is about an hour and a half from San Francisco. Can you just talk about the relationship between community members in Sacramento and police there?
I mean, there's no relationship. I mean, you, of course, have the police that always like to use the narrative, the cops and clergy. They have relationship with folks they want to have relationships with, but the people that they're policing, the folks they're targeting, they don't have a relationship with them. I mean, it's easy for the police to come in moments of clarity when you can bring a basketball and play some hoops, bring a bicycle, come visit a school. But in the moments when you're challenged, that adversity, I think that's when we lose that sense of, okay, we are a community. the fact that this young man got killed in the back of his grandparents' home, it speaks volumes on what we thought as our community, where we're going to get to deal with new policing. And I think that the trust level, first of all, was never then. The racism in this police precinct has always been there, and the corruption. We have a new police chief, and I think that was giving, putting a Band-Aid on cancer to a bleeding wound. So you have a new police chief thinking that it was going to be a miracle, but we all knew that this moment was going to happen, because just because we have a new police chief that's black doesn't mean that he's wiped away all the racism and all the bias that's been in this SAC PD.
Mm. And also, two of the officers who shot Stephon Clark, one was white and one was black, right?
Yes. But I don't, I mean, you have a black face with white intentions. Just because he's a black male, he has a badge. The unfortunate thing about the folks in the blue, when they put on that badge, it doesn't matter what color they're in, they bleed blue. Mm. And they let you know that. I mean, it's a gang. I mean, let's not be confused, but the police are. They used to be slave patrol. They are the biggest gang in America. And they're just often they look like an army. So they have military tactics. They just kind of look at folks on the street, especially folks in impoverished areas like Meadowview, as just easy prey. So the police officers that kind of just went in and just became judge, jury, and executioner, they need to be held accountable. And I think that Sacramento has an opportunity to really show the nation what we need to do when it comes to reforming or dismantling police as far as we know it.
Barry Axius is a community activist in Sacramento who founded The Voice of the Youth, a group that mentors at-risk youth struggling with schools, their peers, and their families. Adriana, you have worked with families of young men of color who have been shot and killed by police here in San Francisco. And like I said, we have done so many shows about these killings. I mean, you understand how the system works because you have been so closely involved. What was your reaction when you heard about yet another killing of an unarmed young man of color, in this case, Stephon Clark?
First of all, I just want to tell the community in Sacramento that my heart really goes out to them, because we just had also a killing in the Mission District again, not even a month ago, of a young man, a Latino man. And the type of trauma the community faces, the type of reactivation of old traumas, it's a never-endless process of accumulating harms. And so one of the first things that I try to do is just to make sure the families understand that we're with them, because this road is long. Mm. Those of us who have chosen to be kind of like single-minded in the purpose of like focusing on these cases so that they're not forgotten, we understand that the media will only pay attention at the next killing, maybe when a case advances at some point, and sincerely, Rose, when there's an uprising. Those are the only three moments I have noticed where these cases get any attention. And mm-hmm. anything else, you know, in terms of reform, it just becomes, I think Barry just said, a Band-Aid on a cancer. So that's the same experience we're having in San Francisco, also with a new police chief who is black, mm-hmm. and also under a reform process that was supposed to bring a different environment in the city. And to the contrary, it's actually escalated policing in gentrified neighborhoods and put people of color who are minorities in the city, and you know, in terms of demographics also, particularly black San Franciscans, at greater risk.
Neil Franklin, you're executive director of the Law Enforcement Reform Group, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. You are a 34-year law enforcement veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. For so long, we have heard former police, current police, politicians talk about law enforcement reform, and yet these killings still happen. What are your overall thoughts about the anger, the pain that so many people continue to feel?
Well, number one, I get it. I've been on both sides. Obviously, 34 years in policing, and now for the past decade, I've been in this place of, you know, how do we deal with these issues that we're faced with? And, you know, I want to say that Barry brought up some very good points. Number one, that police have never really been in a place where they are, beneficial to communities of color. Historically, there's been that great disconnect between communities of color and police in this country. So that's a place we have never been, and that's a place we have to create. He also talked about police and community. Those police officers who work and patrol in communities of color never really being connected. And let me just say that I'm speaking in generalities, because there are always unique circumstances, and many of which I have witnessed, where you have some really good individual police officers who do make a concerted effort to know the members of the community on a daily basis, 24/7, not just, you know, as Barry said, you know, you bring out the basketball, shoot some hoops occasionally when things are calm and so on. But generally speaking, police officers are, and let me speak to Baltimore, and I want to speak to Baltimore, number one, because I know it well. I grew up there, a police there, and I know it well. And Baltimore is stricken with some serious issues and problems within its police department, and also with dealing with violent crime within certain communities. In a city like Baltimore, you know, we constantly move police officers around, and they don't get the opportunity to spend day after day after day in a neighborhood. They aren't held accountable for getting to know the people who live in those communities. You know, they drive around in cars. They have to be forced to get out of their cars and walk up and down the streets and interact with people. It shouldn't be the citizens who have to reach out to the police and, you know, to even strike up a conversation. You know, these should be the police making that effort to do that and make that happen. This is a very complex issue, and it's going to take a lot of work to fix. And I get and I understand the pain within the communities, you know, that are dealing with these types of murders and issues of excessive force by the ones that are supposed to be protecting us. I have much to say about this, but I want to say something that's extremely critical. We have to get to a place where the police are truly under the control of the community. I'm not at a place where we don't need the police, because unfortunately we have conditions in this country of poverty and again, you know, the war on drugs, where you can go sell drugs and make money, and, you know, and the crime that comes with that, because it's an illegal activity. But we create conditions that promote violent crime within our communities, mainly the condition of poverty. And until we deal with that, unfortunately, we're going to need people to come in and deal with that. But I just want to say that police need to be under the control of the community, not of a mayor, city manager, or governor. And I think we can do that. But and I think that's a place that we need to go to.
And we'll talk about poverty and communities that are under-resourced later in the show, but I also want to talk about holding police accountable, because when a young person of color is killed by police, this is what a lot of activists talk about, that police are not held accountable. And Barry, activists in Sacramento are putting the pressure on Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert to press criminal charges against the officers who killed Stephon Clark. Do you have any updates on that?
Well, we're going to have a action, and we're going to continue to have an action in front of her office that she doesn't somehow come out of, or she leaves through the back door and closes for the day. I just wanted to touch on my man's piece. Everything I was in agreement to, but we got to remember that war on drugs was actually a war on black people. We have to understand that Nixon plan was not a war on drugs, it was a war on black people, and that kind of initiates more of where we're at, unfortunately. But as far as, again, the actions that we're going to be taking on in the DA, we're not, And by no means, we are not going to sit back and allow her to think that she's just going to be able to be reelected without a fight. We're going to put major pressure on her, because she has not prosecuted or brought up charges to anyone. And that's the unfortunate part. She's also was given a $13,000 from, I want to say, the police board or commission or some piece like that, to where, and this was 2 days after the shooting. So when you see, like, wait a minute, she got a donation of $13,000. What's that about? So when we scale back the corruption that is the police, the law enforcement here in Sacramento, it's got layers, and it's and layered with racism, layered with bias. So we just have to kind of and I love the point of the community piece. The community is not saying we don't need police. But what we're saying is the police that we have right now, this system that we have right now, if we can't reform it, it must be dismantled. And we need to rebuild it with the community at the top of it. I mean, we can't have the folks like the city manager controlling things, the DA controlling things, this police union that's so powerful, and the simple fact that these police are protected by the Police Bill of Rights. These are all things that we're challenging. And as I also would like to say, that in these non-lethal or lethal weapons, why aren't these police being drug tested? I mean, these things are possibilities to save folks' lives. I think when you stretch out and take away some of that power that evidently they're abusing, it kind of makes an even playing field for the folks, for the people, and we can feel protected and safe, because we don't feel protected and safe. I cannot call a police officer and I have to hope that the results will be good, but the results always vary. So that's a negative place to be if I'm thinking that someone that I'm paying my tax dollars to, I can't call them because I don't know what the situation might be. He might mistaken me as the criminal, and I might be dead.
Barry Axios is a community activist in Sacramento who founded The Voice of the Youth. It's a group that mentors at-risk youth struggling with schools, their peers, or their families. We're also joined today by Neil Franklin, Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Reform Group, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Neil is a 34-year law enforcement veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. Adriana Camarena is a San Francisco-based activist accompanying the family of police shooting victims, including Luis Gongora Pat. He was shot and killed in the Mission District of San Francisco almost 2 years ago by two police officers. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on this latest killing of Stephon Clark, a 22-year-old father of two, an unarmed black man who was shot 8 times and killed, according to an independent autopsy? We have done so many shows about this issue, and we don't see many changes. We keep hearing reform, reform, reform. Well, what does that mean exactly? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email your call at kalw.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, facebook.com/KALW Public Radio. We're live there. Click on the video and then take part in the conversation. All right, let's just get real here and talk about reform and what needs to change. Barry, you're in Sacramento. What are you hearing from fellow activists about the changes they would like to see?
You know, we have a police commission over here, and it has no subpoena power. So whatever police commission that is formed and has community, you know, that the community is involved with, we believe that we should have subpoena power. We're also looking at the Police Bill of Rights, of course. That has to be looked at severely. It has to kind of be, I think, rewritten in some ways to kind of level out the power that the police have, as well as taking some of the power away from, you know, public officials like the city manager. You know, so we're looking at all these different components, and we're not out here on the streets just doing it because we think it's fun. We are out here because we know, as the young lady said earlier, if we don't get on the streets, if we don't make this national news, this goes away. And we can continuously have business as usual, as well as looking at excessive force. The excessive force being used, there was already something that we put in after the Joseph Mann incident in 2016. We fought for the police to make sure that they use non-lethal weapons before they use a lethal weapon. And this wasn't – this didn't happen. You know, they just decided to kill this man, execute this man in a public lynching, to be honest with you. So I think that when we are looking at it on a local level, we're also – paying attention to the statewide level, and then soon that as we pull these things, I feel that we can. I think there was momentum. Then we'll look at it on a national level, and I feel that Sacramento has a great opportunity to be a progressive city. Excuse me, to really push real true change and let folks know who are going to join the police force that there's going to be no longer these rogue executioners, these henchmen on board. You're going to have to work with the community, and you're going to have to protect and serve all people in the community.
Adriana, what would you add? What reforms would you like to see based on the experiences that you've had here in San Francisco?
Well, I think we have to think about why cases fall apart. Why isn't there accountability? And one of the main reasons is what many of you have already heard, that officers say that they felt threatened in the moment. And those are almost like magic words, because the legal standards in the laws, and this is across the nation, say that if an officer perceives a threat to their lives or serious bodily injury to themselves or another, that they can use lethal force. And at that moment, it's a catch-all. It's a catch-all for, it's a catch-all for all actions that they carry out will be deemed legal. And this is the standard that needs to change. I heard, I was looking at the news this morning, and I think the ACLU is floating the idea of changing that standard. And this is a standard that's not only in legislation and local legislation, but is also supported by the courts. So there is also the issue of why prosecutors won't pursue cases. In the case of San Francisco, just take our current district attorney, George Gascon, who entered office in 2011. There have been 51 police shootings since 2011, 22 of them fatal. And in not one single case has he pursued charges against the officers. He's resolved 83% of those cases. Luis Gongora Pat's case is one of the cases that we're waiting any moment right now to hear. And at this point, it's not only about legislation, but we have to look at the role of the police, the prosecutors, the police commissions, the lack of accountability and transparency all across the board to understand why is there that there's a continuous impunity, like 100% police impunity in San Francisco, for shootings and killings and abuses.
And Neil Franklin, you spent 34 years with the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. What are your thoughts about police accountability?
So that's very important, because I first want to say that the police are trained very well in general. Again, I was the head of training for the Maryland State Police for a couple of years, and I was also the head of training for the Baltimore Police Department, two largest police agencies in the state of Maryland. Let me just say that, in general, police are trained very, very well. Training is not the issue here. It is accountability. Also, police are not – another problem is that police are not educated very, very well. What I mean by educated, training is about skill sets, about doing whatever in the right – in a particular circumstance, you know, crossing the T's and dotting the I's. But education is about knowing a community. Education is about knowing the history of the place that you work. Education is about knowing, as Barry said, the history of the war on drugs and what that's all about and what that means. It is, in fact, a war on people, but we don't educate very well. Accountability is where we're really missing the boat here. And what Adriana said about the standard, you know, of a threat and the court, how the judicial process has supported that. But the question is the threat reasonable? So looking at this most recent case with Mr. Clark, was that threat reasonable? And I'm not saying one thing or another, because there's still a lot that needs to be done, but here are the questions that need to be asked. And then the accountability comes into play. You know, what information did the officers receive? You know, what are the conditions that they're responding in? One of the things that we did see through the video from the helicopter is that these officers were at the corner of the building, actually have cover, and they did actually follow their training to seek cover, you know, and then slow things down. But it doesn't appear as though they took the opportunity, and I said appear, it doesn't appear as though they took the opportunity to slow things down. They had cover, concealment, at the corner of the building. Now, did they take the time to slow things down and open up dialogue with the person they were pursuing, Mr. Clark? Doesn't look good at the moment. That's all from what we're able to see with the videos that we've been able to view and the audio that we have. So these are the things that need to be considered. But, and then there has to come the accountability. You know, you have to look at the training. Another place that we're missing the boat here across this country is the mental health aspect of the police officers from the day that they're hired to the day that they leave the force, there should be regular assessments regarding the mental state of being, annual assessments, not just after an incident. You know, I think it was Barry that mentioned drug testing. Yes, after every such incident. And even besides that, you should have random drug testing for any police officer that carries a gun.
Amen.
And again, after the incident, immediately, there should be drug testing. So there are many places where we're missing the boat regarding the mental state of mind for these particular officers. Issues of PTSD are running rampant in our police departments. We're not dealing with that appropriately. But at the end of the day, we've got to get to a place of holding the police officers accountable, of holding their first-line supervisors accountable, of holding middle management accountable, and ultimately holding the police leaders and policymakers accountable. At every level, we're missing the boat.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Neil Franklin is Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Reform Group Law Enforcement Action Partnership. He spent 34 years with the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. Barry Axios is a community activist in Sacramento, and Adriana Camarena works with families in Sacramento who have lost loved ones. I'm sorry, San Francisco, thank you, who have lost loved ones to police violence, including Louis Gongora Pat. He was shot and killed in the Mission District almost 2 years ago by two police officers. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On April 4th, 1968, he was in Memphis to support a sanitation worker strike. In the months before his assassination, he advocated for the poor and an end to the Vietnam War. We will mark the 50th anniversary by discussing his fight for justice and where we are 50 years later. Today, we are talking about Stephon Clark, a 22-year-old father of two, an unarmed black man who was shot and killed on March 18th. He was shot 8 times, and according to an independent autopsy, no gun was recovered at the scene. Police found only a cell phone. We're talking about this with Barry Axios, a community activist in Sacramento who founded the Voice of the Youth, a group that mentors at-risk youth. Neil Franklin is executive director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a law enforcement reform group. He spent 34 years with the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. And Adriana Camarena is a San Francisco-based activist working with families who lost loved ones in San Francisco. She's working with the family of Louis Gongora Pat. He was shot and killed in the Mission almost 2 years ago by two police officers. We're going to get to calls in a minute, but Adriana, you wanted to respond to Neil's comments about reform.
Yes, and you know, I do understand where Neil is coming from, reform. In fact, I have some experience with reform, and I've been participating until recently in the reform tables of the San Francisco Police Department. But at this point, it feels like a red herring to talk about improving training or seeing whether the officers didn't use their training or whether maybe, you know, if we just, all of this can help, you know, transparency. But what ends up happening is that we don't get to the root of the issue, which is that we're dealing with an organization that's disconnected from community and has a deeply ingrained racist, bigoted, violent past. And I'm not exaggerating. because if you look into even just the recent history, and I became involved in these cases after Alex Nieto was shot on Bernal Heights. He was a local Mission, born and raised homeboy who was just eating his burrito at the park. And two people, white people, white techies, new to San Francisco, called the police on him because they were afraid of a man eating a burrito. And unquestionably, the police took that description and just raced up the hail and killed him in a hail of 59 bullets. I mean, consider the case of Luis Gongora Pat. The use of force standard had been reformed earlier that year to encourage the use of de-escalation. Luis was living homeless at the time. He's a Mayan man. Spanish is his second language. He didn't speak English. He was sitting by all eight eyewitness accounts, sitting against a wall when police got out of their patrol car. And in less than 28 seconds, they shot him with 5 beanbag rounds and 7 bullets, with an execution-style shot to the head when he was already on the ground. And then you take the latest case of Adolfo Delgado, who's this terrified teenager, terrified of being deported, who's hidden in the trunk of a car. And he is surrounded, yelled commands at. He's being shot at with beanbags before, even as he's complying with commands. And then when he shows his left hand, the police shoot 100 bullets at him. Like, what? At this point, you have to question the mindset. And I don't think at this point that it's beyond asking to abolish the police. I know it sounds like, oh, my God, the word abolish. What does it mean? We need police. All that has been said. I understand. But it's not only about community control of the police. If we're going to get elsewhere, it's community control of the process of what we of laying down the community standards by which we want youth of color to be treated. We want immigrants to be treated. How we want people who are extremely poor, often also people of color, to be treated in our communities. And I have to say, powerful and communities points. Also carry this intrinsic bias. Mm. So we have to have some inward-looking processes that question communities on the whole.
That is Adriana Camarena. She works with families in San Francisco who have lost loved ones to police violence. We have a number of callers on the line. Let's go through a few, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Vicki in Oakland. Hi, Vicki. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. So my question is, I'm very curious because I'm hearing that the police in the Sacramento community are very much distrusted because of bad relationships over time. And given that it was likely that the person or persons who made a call to the police, 911 or otherwise, were probably neighbors of the victim, and possibly persons of color, what response might they have been expecting when calling the police for a property crime that was in progress?
Can you elaborate on that, Vicki?
Presumably, there was supposedly police were called because there was, there was car, vandalism taking place.
Right.
And I haven't heard one way or the other if the victim was in fact the person who was, vandalizing the cars. But I'm assuming that it was probably neighbors of, witnessing this vandalism, and that they had made the police call for intervention, obviously. And since it was a neighborhood sort of problem, I wondered if there's been any conversation or investigation of what those callers to the police were hoping for with a police, when they called in a property crime in an area where supposedly the police are very distrusted
I see what you're saying. All right. Actually, let's take that one. Barry, would you like to respond to Vicki?
I don't think it's a complicated question at all. I think that the idea of there's a certain individuals that trust police and there's certain individuals that don't trust police. I don't think anybody, when you call the police, you're thinking that they're going to assassinate somebody or execute somebody. So I'm sure that person that called is probably sick to their stomach. And on the property piece, we still have yet to find out if he was actually the suspect. I mean, we don't know. There's no evidence that says that he was connected to whatever burglary, whatever knocking down windows on cars. That's yet to be found. And at the same particular time, isn't that a misdemeanor? If anything, does that deserve execution? So in the sense of, I think people try to create this narrative that, well, the police were in their right because he was doing this. There's nothing that young man did except be black and have a hoodie and just be in the wrong place at the wrong time where some insensitive and very ignorant police just abused their powers and used excessive force, I don't know, to prove a point. There was nothing he did wrong. So, I mean, when we try to create this narrative as if, you know, the call and there are broken windows, as if that's okay, it's not okay. And I think that we kind of use these things as excuses for the police to run rogue and run rampant and beat these animals on the streets. And when they call black people savages, I look at the police force and say, they're the only savages that I know, the only gang that walks around here with this grudge against people that don't even really do anything to them. So I think... Again, I also like to state the fact that we're in this place is because SAC PD created this narrative. They lied.
Thank you.
They lied about what actually happened. And I think that's why the story is bigger than what it is, because we ask for transparency, accountability, and justice if police do things wrong. And we've got none of those things.
Adriana.
Sure. And then I just want to say that what Barry is referencing is something that we activists call character assassination. And you have to understand the type of this imbalance that exists between a family who's just been impacted by violent, brutal death of a loved one and the state, the city, who has all resources at their hands, especially the police department with communications, a communications department, access to the media. They will put out a narrative that actually sustains what I say, the only police narrative, the one where they feel threatened for their lives. And that's why they shoot. So I only say that any police shooting, there's only one narrative that the police ever puts out. And so we have to be careful when we think about these cases, because the question is also always, what was the victim doing? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to ask forgiveness right now for people who have suffered sexual violence, but it is the same thing that happens around rape victims, whereas the victim has to defend themselves, and they're dead in most of these cases. And, you know, it's one of these cases where we have to start asking, what was the police doing? Why exactly did they come into these situations this way? What did they know? Like in the case of Alex Nieto, all they knew was that he was eating near a bench. That's all they knew. And so you have to take it, you have to ask question by question to say, what was the police thinking? And when you see it from that perspective, you realize that they enter these situations with what is called intrinsic bias. And it is part of their training. And they're also trained, once they fear for their lives, to pull their guns, not to harm or defuse conflict, but they're trained to kill. So there is no other outcome in these situations around police training. And so I just want to be careful when we look at these questions, just be critical about where you're getting your information from, and just hold on to these words around character assassination of the victim.
Neil, you wanted to jump in there?
Yeah, so I agree with some of what has been said, but I do disagree with the training aspect, and here's my point. Because police are trained to de-escalate, and when I say, I'm talking about generally speaking now, they are trained to de-escalate. They are trained in the use of force continuum and how to begin just with their mere presence. They are trained to open up dialogue. The problem is, and here's the thing, I responded to a number of calls like this in my career, a number of calls in the middle of the night and by myself. And yes, you are frightened, you are scared. The difference is, do you have the courage to stick with what you've been trained, to slow things down, to open up dialogue, you know, to do those things, to put yourself, to not put yourself into a situation or a condition to where you may have to use deadly force. You know, to have the mindset to think about the sanctity of life and to understand that your life is last in this scenario and that everyone else's life is first. You know, generally speaking, that is how we train. The problem is where the culture of policing has migrated to at the street level. And what has also been discussed about bias. Yes, that culture in the street, the blue versus black. Mm. It's not white versus blue versus black. And that culture that has come about and we've allowed to exist and to grow because of the lack of accountability at all levels. So,
but I just want to say one thing with Neil. What I think the culture has been created by them, not us. And when you're talking about the different things they could have done to de-escalate, if you're in fear, then call backup. If you're in fear, why don't you have the helicopter shine the bright light that I remember wanting from the police? The bright light got shined on me. And when you're in fear, why don't you say who you are? The police officers didn't even attempt to bring and say, we are police officers. So right then, those are kind of like those things where I'm saying, so what was their mindset? Was it just kill, kill, kill? Because it wasn't de-escalation at that particular point.
Right. So
worse at that point is that despite the fact that there's training, that they're trained to de-escalate, that they should have slowed things down, but the fact is that they don't. And they don't do it also selectively, because in San Francisco in 2016, there was a white man with a gun in front of the city hall, and they had a six-hour standoff, and they called him mentally ill and provided support. When you have the case of Luis, where they're supposedly de-escalating by firing beanbag rounds at him, but in fact they're escalating, and at the end there's absolute impunity because they say the magic words.
To that point, according to a number of reports, this one from The Guardian, black males ages 15 to 34 are 9 times more likely than others to be killed by law enforcement. This was just last year. Neil, if I can ask you, I mean, you spent 34 years with the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore Police Departments. You are a black police officer. Can you talk about the differences you have seen between how black and white police officers respond to young men of color versus young white men in these kinds of situations where you don't know if there's a gun involved, you don't know what you're walking into?
Generally speaking, again, because you've got police officers that do great work, you got police officers that are serious problems who never should have had a badge and a gun to begin with, and that's accountability. But again, the thing is, whether you're a white officer or a black officer, generally speaking, the response is the same. You know, there is no difference. You know, I've seen black officers, and I've held black officers accountable. I pulled them up in the street and chastised them and have done what needs to be done after that. Black officers disrespecting their brothers and sisters within the communities that they serve. You know, I've seen the same thing with white officers. You can just go online and you see it. Thank goodness for videos today, because now we can see it. This isn't something new.
But what is the difference between how they respond when they're dealing with a young man of color, for example, versus a young white man?
I mean, because of the culture and the bias that exists, generally speaking, it's disrespect. There's a big difference. You know, we understand in that culture, they understand that a young white man is more likely to have power and influence.
Yes, sir.
To do something about that interaction, you know, once it occurs. So they're going to treat that person better.
With a little bit more
they
respect.
They see a young black man that's not having political power, not having the financial ability to do something about it. And I'll be just straightforward. Generally speaking, they don't see that individual as a person. And therefore, they don't give them the respect as a person. I mean, to hear some of the offline conversations, you know, among the ranks of the men and women out there in uniform, you know, as they're talking about our young men of color, whether they're Latino young men or whether they're black young men, it's disgraceful. And again, it's because that we don't hold folks accountable. You know, that's why right now Oakland City has a chance with this 9-member board, community-based board, to continue moving in a direction where that community can gain complete control over that police department. Do not give it back to the mayor. Do not give it back to the city council. The community needs to have control over the police department. If you're going to reconstruct policing,
in this country, the community has to do it. It's not going to happen through our policymakers. The community needs to gain control, and then you need to rebuild that police department from the bottom up. And we just need one city, one town, one place to do it, and you'll see the results.
Well, and I think this is one of the key points, because we hear reform, reform, reform. We need to go deeper and be real about what we're dealing with. And Neil, as a 34-year veteran in Maryland and Baltimore, you just said that when black and white officers see youth of color, in some cases they don't see them as human. The way they talk about them is horrific. I mean, we've seen this with San Francisco police and their racist texts. So this is where we need to start the conversation, really, talking about how these police officers see young men of color. Adriana?
Yes, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because what I want to point out is that these killings just don't happen to people of color because there's a call about vandalism or a car break-in. It happens to them because it takes place in a context. And in San Francisco, as we learned very clearly during those years of 2015 and 2016, there was a racist text scandal that, first of all, was revealed when it was learned that police officers were breaking in to the hotel rooms, the SRO rooms of the poorest people in San Francisco, and stealing from them and filing false police reports. And it was from these cases that when they tried to parole one of those officers who was charged with corruption charges, Firminger, that they learned that there was this series of racist texts, very lengthy, involving many people. And Rose, they tried at some point, out of damage control, to fire these officers, and they couldn't do it under the POBAR, the Police Officers Bill of Rights, because they said they hadn't, you know, filed for firing them in time. And so there's constant sabotage by the legal system, which protects police, and then the prosecutors protect police. So we're pitted against a system that doesn't actually want justice in any of these cases. And they want to, you know, maintain this myth that police are for the good of the people. But you start to ask, which people? And this is why, if we're going to talk about reform, then let's create the right platform where it involves the people who are more disproportionately hurt by policing, and not just those people who are worried about their property. Because for me, there's a direct connection between police protecting property, police killing people, and then the prosecutors protecting the police. And we just have to look at the whole system of lack of transparency and accountability when we talk about these issues, but also through community control of the process. Mm.
To that point, let's take a quick call. We're almost out of time, but let's hear from Starchild in San Francisco. Hi, Starchild. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much, Mr. Moretti, down here. So I was very glad to hear Adriana saying that, raising the idea, because I think it should be part of the discussion of abolishing the police. Anthony Gregory wrote a great essay for LouRockwell.com on this, and I think as a step in that direction, if people were simply allowed to choose where their tax money goes, or even better yet, how much of it to send to the government, we in the community would have the power to abolish the police, because people could choose or not choose to fund them depending on whether they were reforming themselves and how they were behaving.
Well, thank you for the comment. Adriana, can you give us updates about what is happening with the police force? Because there have been a lot of changes. And, I mean, as Starchild said, if we could have more say about where our tax money goes for any number of issues, things would really change. But what sort of effect has the community had on the police force in San Francisco?
Well, you know,
just briefly.
Sure. You remember that after Luis was killed, Luis Góngora Pat, the Frisco Five rose up and had a hunger strike that actually led to the chief of police then, Greg Sir, and the mayor, Ed Lee, to call for a reform. And they promised that they were going to create a deep reform based on the most innovative policing practices. But what has happened is that without deep, constant community involvement and attention, what this happens is that it's a reform that suffers from the same insularity that SFPD has. So while there are reform tables that are looking at community policing, use of force, bias, accountability, recruitment, hiring, and personnel practices, It's the reform that nobody understands and nobody knows about. And so it ends up being like a duck dead in the water, because community members who are impacted by policing are not actually either understanding it, supporting it, or creating deep input into the direction, the goals of a new department. And I think this is where I have to say, I understand that SFPD is making efforts, but these are misdirected efforts until they create the, they engage the community to create the right platform to provide the goals and vision and direction for the SFPD.
And we'll continue to follow that. Barry, we have just about a minute left. What is next in Sacramento?
I mean, just constant pressure on the DA. We'll have a city hall meeting today. We're talking to a lot of public officials. We are building a movement called Build Black, which is focusing on, you know, empowering the black community educationally, economics, as well as, you know, dealing with the policing, holding them accountable. So there's a lot of great and powerful things that is going on here in Sacramento. I believe that we are a progressive city, and I think that a lot of the officials have seen that our cries from 2014 to now, they're listening. And I don't think that folks want to be in a part, the side of history that falls where they are the ones that continue to keep these rogue police in business. I think they want to see the change. I'd also want to state that we have to look at the basis of what this policing thing is, and the deeper conversation about race, because race always plays the issue. Mm-hmm. And I ask this question, I say, well, what happened to all those Klans members when they sat there and they put their white hoods all away? They picked up badges. They became positions in political office. So this is kind of why this thing continues to shape up, because the police are the pawns for white supremacy. They are the gatekeepers. So with them, that's why they're in line, because if you dismantle them, now folks are feeling like their power is away, and that's the 1%. So it's either the 1% or white supremacy that wants to continue to keep these race soldiers around. And that's just the basic line of what we're at, blue versus everyone. And if folks don't understand that it's happening to black people, it could eventually happen to you. No one is exempt.
Well, and the FBI was even looking into that about 10 years ago. We recently did a show about that. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Barry Axius is a community activist in Sacramento who founded The Voice of the Youth, a group that mentors at-risk youth. Neil Franklin is executive director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership. He's a 34-year veteran of the Maryland State Police and Baltimore Police Departments. Adriana Camarena is a San Francisco-based activist working with families of loved ones who were shot and killed by police in San Francisco. Thank you all for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.